Hi, I'm Bruce Cohn Curtis, producer.
I'm screenwriter David Lowry.
I'm makeup artist Craig Reardon.
Wonderful cast. I'm sorry that Dennis Quaid isn't here and Kate Capshaw. Kate would have come if Dennis would have done it. And he always loved this picture, actually. He always wanted to do Dreamscape. And outside of one other actor, he was our first choice. He'd worked with Joe Rubin on another film and actually started with... He was an extra in and also in a Joe Rubin film, so we all knew each other very well.
Yeah, he had just done Breaking Away, I think, before this.
Oh, more than a lot of
a couple of years before.
Yeah, a couple of the pictures. Richard Halsey, Academy Award winner for the boxing picture. What was the one? Stallone, Rocky.
Yeah, right.
My brother Tom, who helped raise the money for this picture, thus his important credit, found Stanley Zupnik, our dear friend.
Another Academy Award winner here.
He was actually the first person, the first creative person hired for the picture was Maurice. I felt, as this was an independently produced movie, that having Maurice would lend credibility to the project. Joe and I had done another picture together, Joyride, so this was our second film.
And you'd done several with Chuck Russell, too.
Yeah, a total of seven.
Really?
Pictures, yeah. This was the first time he wrote the script.
Yeah.
I mean, got involved, got a writing credit on this.
There she is on the treadmill, with the rolling pin coming up behind her. Eddie Alpert is the president. I think he actually was president for a few years back in the 80s.
Well, he was very close to Ronald Reagan and used to tell us wonderful stories about Reagan. This is Madison Mason. We did another picture together after this. But he ended up doing aspirin commercials, I think, or had a big career. Nice, a nice guy.
You know, I think Eddie's still working.
I don't think so.
No, within a couple of years, though, I've seen him.
Oh, yeah,
some
but
stuff.
How old is Eddie as we speak? 1999. In his 90s, I think.
I would think he'd be close to that, sure.
Close to God's age.
I remember him always in the trailer playing his guitar, singing folk songs.
That's right.
Yep. Wonderful Max von Sydow.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were really lucky to get him. He was great. And we all know what happened to Kate.
Yes. Actually, she wanted to do the picture, then she didn't want to do the picture, and then I had to convince Dennis to go and get her to do the movie. He didn't, because she had turned it down initially, he didn't want her, but I said, Dennis, she'd be so right for this, she'd be so good, you must go and get her. So he arranged a lunch to talk her into doing the film, which luckily she said yes to. And of course from this she got the Spielberg picture.
Yeah, I think she got...
Temple of Doom.
At the time we were doing the movie.
Right. Well, this was actually what you're going to see coming up now. This was the first day of shooting.
Right, Los Alamitos.
Yes, and it was raining that day, so we had to reschedule everything.
We got it rained like hell that year, I remember.
Yeah. We had a lot of rain.
Yeah, so it wasn't a good omen for the beginning of the picture, but this was...
This is stock, this the race itself.
But this was the first day of shooting, February 2nd, 1983.
Right.
I had to look that up.
I wish you hadn't.
I know.
It was just yesterday.
I remember we had another scene in here that we cut. Remember with Nina Axelrod?
Oh, that's right.
Remember there's a girl that Dennis bumps into, tries to pick up, realizes that he's already had a one-night stand with her, and then kind of slinks away.
You're absolutely right. We should have put that back in the picture. It's a wonderful scene. It's very good. I forgot. It's a wonderful actor, Redmond Gleason. I forgot about that, Nina Axelrod.
Yeah, it was about a two-minute scene.
It's one of the few things that were cut.
And actually, I have to interrupt because you're about to see something. See that guy in the dark
jacket? Oh, that's you.
Yeah.
That's right. David Lowry.
Alfred Hitchcock.
Was that making your screen debut?
That was my screen debut. Except for some Super 8 movies when I was a kid.
Brian Libby on the right, who's continues working today. Here's the great Betty Keene, who's since passed away, and I used her in all my films because she was like my good luck charm. If I wanted a laugh, I got Betty, and we got a laugh on that line.
Yeah, she got a big laugh.
Yeah, she was just wonderful.
You're going to have to teach you a little lesson about sharing the wealth. If you want to stay healthy, you and me are going to be partners.
Actually, the only other actor that was considered for this was John Schneider.
From Dukes of Hazzard.
He was hot then, but we just wanted to go with Dennis in the end. And he loved this so much, he wanted to do this picture.
Well, he was the right choice.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I'm sorry he's not here. I never got to speak to him, so who knows? You know, today with every of these stars have their handlers.
He was great in those things. Nice ride.
Didn't we add that, I think?
I think Dennis just sort of ad-libbed that one. Everybody pretty much stayed to the script, but I think there were occasions when Dennis would throw something in.
I thought maybe we added that in, this was funny.
I think that's a New York cab, isn't it?
It looks like it, huh? How did that get in there?
Came a long way to get it.
This was unusual, this set, because I think it was actually in the building that we used for the exterior, which is sort of rare in movies. In the original script, Alex Gardner, Dennis's character, played the violin. I'm not sure why we changed that.
Because he wanted to play this. He played this, didn't he, I think?
Well, he played something here. It wasn't the music we're hearing right now, because this is the
theme
that Maurice Jarre wrote.
You're absolutely right. I remember him noodling on the saxophone in his trailer, maybe in concert with Eddie Albert across the way.
Well, there's another saxophone player that we'll see a little later who plays not quite so well. Yeah, this is the exterior. And this is just off Sunset.
Right.
Just sort of up from the Tiffany Theater.
You're absolutely right.
This building still looks exactly the same. Peter Jason.
Yes. I just saw him the other day.
And Chris Mulkey.
Both of them have had a good career since then.
Peter's the classic, decent, funny guy who plays a great, rotten villain.
Perfect. And he also, I think, does a lot of bartender commercials where he plays the affable bartender. We remember this day because it wasn't raining.
There was one?
In watching this the other night, I was trying to see the background. So here's Sunset. This is really where it was. But in a minute, I think all our backgrounds are Beverly Boulevard over in Fairfax District. I think Joe was sort of scrunched down there between the front seat and Dennis.
You must also make note, was Brian Tofano's first, wasn't it his first American film? Or
I think it was.
Yeah. There's a cinematographer. I guess I'd have to stop you.
Just sit back. Yeah, we were thrilled to get Brian. He had done Quadrophenia, which impressed Joe especially.
We brought him over from England.
Mm-hmm.
I said, see, Joe, I'll give you anything you want. Almost. Now, here's the
Pacific Coast Highway.
Yeah.
And, of course, they picked a shot here that you've only seen in about 1,000 different car commercials. Everybody knows this location.
But then it wasn't so much used.
No, it was much smaller then. Yeah. It's much bigger now. It grew.
Now, this here is the University of the Pacifica.
The only story I remember about this place was that our cameraman, we were just talking about, Brian Tofano, who was English, and I think still is, really hated American food and was just in heaven, eating the blandest food you can imagine at the college cafeteria.
This is not University of Pacifica now.
I think this could be Claremont.
Yeah, we used Claremont colleges. We used about 7 different locations for the actual college. I'm listening to the Maurice Jarre score, the electronic score, and the reason I wanted to go with Maurice, besides being a great composer, was also I wanted a symphonic score, but he decided he wanted to go to electronic, and thus to this day he says he still owes me a symphonic score.
Maybe we could have gotten him back to do one for the DVD.
Yeah. I think I picked out the color of that sweater. I had a wonderful wardrobe. Linda Bass, wardrobe person, did several pictures with me.
I remember we got into long discussions over what Dennis should be writing backwards on this window.
Really?
Yeah.
I get the feeling.
We spent a lot of time just on, well, you know, stuff like that.
Important, though.
Yeah.
Important.
Hello, Alex. I'm Dr. Jane DeVries. We're glad you could come.
Well, perhaps you can tell me what the hell I'm doing here.
We wanted to talk to you about the project that we're working on.
Yeah? You have a think tank full of geniuses who want to try out a new theory?
No.
Well, look.
Dennis had shot the right stuff, but it hadn't come out yet. I think it came out the summer of 83, just after we finished. And he was also in Jaws 3D.
Well, that's where I went down to talk to him, right.
Yeah.
I remember him in a movie called The Long Riders with his brother Randy, which had a lot of brother actors.
Oh, that's a great picture.
Before this also.
Yeah.
It was a great movie, yeah.
And he did the night the lights went out in Georgia.
Right. Think,
and he goes, when we got him, he had about 3 pictures ready to come out.
This was one of our camera assistants
here.
That's right. From out.
I mean, I know 1 or 2 things.
Does some pretty mean REM there.
Yeah, he really had those eyeballs going.
This was the CalArts.
Right.
Yeah.
Here's a Chuck Russell line coming up.
Physical or psychological by monitoring his sleep.
Mm-hmm. How's that?
Well, if it isn't physical, he'll experience 3 or 4 erections during the course of the night.
I see. So, Jane, what you do here in effect is count boners.
Great line. I remember that line, right? Big laugh line. That was such good about the. It was one of the wonderful things about the picture was the sense of comedy and.
Yeah, I was.
It wasn't all serious. It had that light.
I was thinking about how many different genres we tried to blend into this picture. You know, it was science fiction, it was fantasy, it was a thriller, it was a romance. A lot of stuff going on at the same time.
It's CalArts, and then moving right into the set. This was Raleigh.
Yeah, Raleigh.
Raleigh Studios we built here. And I remember we went from one production designer to another, and then the doors weren't...
That's right.
Wasn't the story? The doors weren't high enough or something?
And also the whoever designed this set had done it without really collaborating with Brian.
Brian, the
DP, so we had a lot of trouble lighting this and figuring out how to shoot here.
And how to get the cameras in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a convenient place, I think, to repeat what I said earlier, David, that I was in awe of Max von Sydow, and I met him in the makeup room, and I said, I think you're the greatest actor in the world. And he looked at me aghast. He's such a,
unassuming.
Yeah.
Unassuming man.
Humble, but brilliant man.
Yeah, terrific actor. We were sometimes worried about whether some of the dialogue would work, and Max always pulled it off. He and Christopher Plummer were just terrific. Pros.
Yeah, they're such good actors that you think this is truly an example of they're just making it up as they go along, and of course it's a fine script, but they make it spark to life.
Yeah.
And Dennis is no slouch. He's very natural too.
dropped back. I remember looking at all the different lights and dials and things in this room, trying to figure out what the hell would any of these things do.
For real, or?
Well, yeah. I mean, just trying to make it seem kind of plausible, because we really had to come up with a lot of gobbledygook and pseudoscience to sell this idea.
And yet, that the beauty of it is that he overleaps all those dials later on.
That's right. This place, I remember, this is the Ore House, which no longer exists in Santa Monica on Main Street.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. You sure it's in Santa Monica?
Yeah.
Was it? Where's that?
I'm embarrassed to say I used to hang out there quite a lot.
Yeah. If those girls worked there, who can blame you?
They didn't, though. That was the problem.
That's right. We added them. That was because we added them. It helps with his character. The bon vivant.
That's right.
Cool. Yeah.
Now, this is where Max explains it all.
I think I still don't understand it. I remember going over and over it and saying, you gotta make this clear, I can't understand.
I think the reason it works is because it's really everybody's fantasy. Mm. We're all fascinated by dreams and whether we can control them, and that sort of fantasy of being able to be in another world where you can do whatever it is, you really want to do, where you can make your fantasies come true.
We all contributed to the dreams. I think I put in the dream about the falling.
Right. So
I remember that because that was a dream I used to have.
What I think is interesting too, David, is that do you ride the dream or does it ride you?
Exactly. Yeah, that was really the point of the movie.
Can you master the dream?
Yeah. We've got another familiar face coming up here in a second, though. Somebody who is very well known for hanging out in bars. Although at the time when we cast this, he wasn't quite so well known.
Absolutely true. I think it was one of his earliest movies. I think one of his first, if not his first. He was so good in the scene, Loncito. He made the scene work.
What I liked was the sort of father-son relationship that they developed. Mm. Okay, get ready. George went. I think he had done about one season of Cheers, but it wasn't really a hit yet. But I do remember that when the movie came out, people were very, very familiar with him, especially in that setting.
And he plays, he's playing a very straight character in this.
Absolutely. Charlie Prince.
Yeah. I like when he puts his hand up.
Yeah, that was a nice little
there.
Touch, literally.
It's a foretelling of...
Yeah, we played kind of fast and loose with Alex's psychic abilities. He seemed to be able to do a lot of different things whenever we needed him to do them.
Buddy's vital signs are increasing.
Serious?
They're escalating.
Seems to have a tough time, poor kid.
Beginning to show signs of extreme agitation.
Yeah, what are they doing there with that keyboard?
It looks real to me. I believed it.
145 rising. 147 now.
What was Lieutenant Uhura always doing?
How's the boy?
Pulse rate extremely rapid. It's rising fast.
But that's part of the fun, I think, trying to figure out what those things do and how they're doing this.
Oh, sure. There's nothing more frightening on Earth than looking into an airplane cockpit and thinking that guy's flying your plane.
Buddy, wake up. Buddy.
This little guy was great.
Yeah, he was.
Corey Bumper
Yellers.
I thought at the time that he was about 7 or 8 years old, and I remember doing some sort of like silly magic trick or card trick to amuse him, and he kind of gave me this sort of little smile, and I later found out he was like 12 or 13, so. I do remember these beds were extremely short, and Dennis had to kind of scrunch up there to look like he'd fit.
I made sure to put him in those underpants, make him walk across there, because he had this, which he still does, but then he had this fantastic body. And I said, Dennis, you have it. You might as well flaunt it.
Oh, cheesecake.
Yeah. And more people to this day remember him walking across the room and said, what a great...
I remember Max wanting to play the scene in his underwear, too. We had to talk him out.
No, really. No, you...
This set was at the Veterans Hospital in Brentwood.
Mm.
Remember, we had a whole wing, a derelict wing of the hospital, in which we built this room and several others.
Mm. That's right. I went back there with another picture, too, after this.
We had an occasional wandering vet, you know, coming onto the set to see what was going on.
That looks very much like a dorm room.
What?
He had wonderful double takes.
Yeah.
You know?
We went for a really cheap cut here, but it really works.
What? Everybody's worst nightmare.
What? Do you understand that? I'm never going to do this for you. Not this way. No way. No. You understand? Never.
Not that's way. I think there was. We left it in because it was the best take of.
Green. That's a transition that always works.
Yeah, in the army uniform on the cut.
One of my favorite lines comes up here.
We didn't tell Dennis what color these cards were going to be, but he got them all right.
I trust you on that one, David.
You've got to sharpen your psychic abilities. You'll have to learn to reach a meditative state in which your mind can conform with the dreamers.
Green. Yellow. Yes.
I love this. Yes.
Yes. I find you attractive.
It's great.
That's just what you were wondering, right? That's what you were thinking.
Knock it off. I'm not going to have you start.
There's a wonderful chemistry between them.
Well, how else do you expect me to warm up the old whammy?
Why can't you take this more serious?
A relaxed chemistry. They're just, you know, building.
Yeah, right.
And they liked each other.
Yeah, so I think that
it
comes across.
It comes across. They genuinely liked each other.
Deep breeze. Let's get on with it.
Okay, Bruce, where are we?
That's UCLA, isn't it? Looks like it. Isn't it? That may have been, I think, UCLA.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
This guy's just had his brain burned there in the dream chamber. Here's that other saxophone player we were talking about. David Patrick Kelly.
He didn't have benefit of an overdub.
Joe wanted to use him because he had seen him in...
The Warriors, I think.
No, the other one.
48 Hours?
48 Hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where he gets hit by the car door when he's running with the bag of money.
Right. He was a wonderful actor.
Yeah, he was great.
He was great in
his
part.
From New York, Joe had seen him and liked him.
He's an astonishing guy. He's done a lot of avant-garde theater pieces, and he's terribly serious, very nice person. Again, playing a despicable wretch.
I remember we were all kind of wary when he showed up because, you know, we'd never seen him not in character in those in those Walter Hill movies where he always played these degenerate weasels. But David was wonderful, and I think that his scenes, especially his scenes with Dennis, for me anyway, are some of the best scenes in the movie. I really get excited when they're on the screen.
Yeah.
I tested a lot of guys for this part, but he had that special quality. That was.
I'm the only guy. I'm the only guy who can do it.
What about Edward Sims?
He had to carry him away in a basket.
One of the things I liked about David, and really about the character that he played, was that you really understood him on a certain level. He had this sort of whopping inferiority complex and sort of need to prove himself, this competition with Dennis.
Yeah.
And he was willing to do anything. He was a total sociopath, but there was something kind of pathetic about him that you could identify a little bit with, understand.
And again, it's that chemistry between them that makes the picture really sing, and like with him and Kate.
It reminds you of the two dedicated fan, or the two unbalanced person against the unknowing focus.
Exactly.
And Dennis is virtually indifferent to him as a character until he realizes that he's a serious danger.
Yeah.
And he has to get serious in a turn.
And it becomes personal. You know, it really becomes, those two guys against each other in the end of this movie, which we've set up here, hopefully.
Again, all these gadgets, which I never understood. Chuck was his domain, Chuck Russell. He loved all this stuff.
Chuck
the
was
hardware.
Really into this stuff.
Yeah.
The fun part about this set was that even though it was on a sound stage, it was enclosed.
Right.
So that when you stepped into this dream chamber area, you really didn't hear anything outside, and you really could kind of believe that this was a possible place.
Here comes the first real Peter Coran thing. Taking us, what do you call it, into the dreams. Dream tunnel.
Well, the dream tunnels, remember, those weren't Peter Coran. Those were done by an underground New York filmmaker, remember?
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the guy's name, but these tunnel effects here. Although Pete did some of this.
Yes, he did some of this.
Some of this on, but these kind of into the tunnel were done by an independent filmmaker in New York who had done a short film, I think, that Joe and Chuck saw and showed you.
That's coming back to me, I think, yeah. Now, we were on top of a building.
I wasn't there.
Yeah, I was there. We were on top of a building downtown. I don't remember exactly, but it was downtown L.A.
Different skyline now.
Yeah.
Hey, look! Look out! Look!
We wanted this first dream to be very quick, for Dennis to just be in it for a very brief time and just sort of get a taste for it.
Yeah, right.
And to set up the fact that there was always danger.
No, I'm a pigeon for this. I hate heights.
Yeah, we wanted to, whenever we could, play into the fears that we thought that the audience would identify with. Heights, snakes. We avoided sharks. Dennis was doing his shark picture that summer. Blue screen.
One thing I admire about Dennis, he plays it cool, he's insouciant, but when the scene is intense and he's got to be frightened and he's got to be, you know, energized or fight the bad guy, boy, he gives it.
Yeah, he's not
everything.
Afraid to hang it out.
Mm-hmm. And there are some actors who are afraid to hang it out.
No,
Dennis, gotta be cool. Gotta be cool. Yeah.
I think Dennis kind of shares that with someone like Harrison Ford, who, when they're put into these situations, aren't afraid to look like human beings as opposed to Superman.
Yeah.
This was Brotman Memorial Hospital.
That's right.
In
That's
Culver
right.
City.
That's right.
Well, those machines are about as frightening as snakes in Heights.
Yeah.
What do you have to do with all this? Oh, I just run it for the government.
Plummer was wonderfully droll in these scenes.
Devaney never said this was a government project.
I remember he was always asking if he could play a scene in a tuxedo. You remember?
Yes.
He always wanted to do a scene where he had just come back from a state affair or something in his tuxedo.
I believe these were his own clothes, too. He brought his own wardrobe.
Yeah, I was going to say that even when he's not wearing a tuxedo, he plays it in a tuxedo.
He's the very image of the arch-villain who never gets his hands dirty.
Right. The character's name was Bob Blair. We never changed that, although I can't think of anybody who sounds less to me like a Bob Blair than Christopher Plummer.
I ran into him last year, and he said that the two roles that everybody stops him for is obviously The Sound of Music and Dreamscape. They
really?
Remember him from Dreamscape. And Kate told me the same thing. She said she was walking once down the Champs-Élysées, and people stopped her and said, Dreamscape.
Good Lord, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Bruce, there's a reason for that in America, because according to a member of my family, this thing's on television on cable about twice a week.
That's had a great play,
yeah.
And will continue as we're in the process of remaking it, so it will go on forever. I said to Joe Rubin, I remember when we did this, I said, Joe, this is the picture you'll be remembered for.
Not the pom-pom girls.
Now, here we're back at the University of Pacifica.
The only objection I ever had to any of these scenes with Buddy is that occasionally they got the dark circles under his eyes a little bit too dark.
I think you're absolutely right.
That was not my department.
No, that was
Craig, I wasn't
Fran.
Looking at you.
That was Fran. But she handled the women very well, because there's a story coming up about that. She handled Kate.
Kate looks beautiful.
You look great. Especially in that sweater.
Yeah, I was going to say, not only her makeup.
Mm-hmm.
Genuine
that
lady.
This was only like her second movie. I mean, she'd done that picture in Chicago.
Yeah, she did Windy City.
Windy City, and this was it. You know, there was heat on her, and from that, though the picture wasn't a success, but she was a definite comer.
I remember one day she brought her daughter to the set, who was about 7 or 8 at that time, and is now a grown-up actress.
Yeah.
An actress.
Surprising.
Yeah, I didn't like this. You're absolutely right. I didn't like this, the makeup here for him. But I wasn't up there at the University of Pacifica. I didn't travel up, so I had to wait to see it in the rushes, and I wasn't particularly pleased. Now that you remind me, Craig, I remember it comes back.
Yeah. I found that if I could talk to somebody, it made me feel a whole lot.
It was raining that day, too.
Well, this was like making a movie during the flood.
It was cold.
Wait till we get to the Bronson cave sequence where we were up to our knees in mud.
You know? I knew you were going to say that.
I saw a couple of pictures recently from that being up there in Bronson Caves, and people were like geared up like it was Alaska.
Yeah, we had trash bags taped around our legs to wade through it. That's the way it goes. This is a beautiful miniature. I remember they had that set up at the old legendary Jerry's Market, where I think they shot portions of Double Indemnity.
Is that right?
Yeah, across from Paramount, that's gone now, when Raleigh expanded out to the street. But they had this beautiful, sprawling, ruined city. I'm going to see some makeup here, which was a lot of little children fidgeting like mad and whimpering a bit, submitted to a lot of very grotesque makeup to be nuclear brazed children. I hate to, precede the shock, but the only way we can fit it in there in time, they're behind that door right there.
Right, but that thing we just saw before, that was a miniature. That we shot that, didn't we?
Yes, sir, yeah. And then this is full scale, of course.
Right.
Look out, here they come. Now with a DVD, you can stop and look at all their nasty little faces.
I remember standing around with some of those kids off...
kind of a nerve
set. Yeah, it was.
You did this to them?
Yeah. Now, this was an interesting location.
A great old house up in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, way up in the hills.
In the hills. This was the home of a very famous Hollywood Western, early Western star.
I think when we scouted this house, we met the caretaker, who was an old German.
Yeah, absolutely
guy,
right.
Who looked like he was out of a Billy Wilder movie.
Yes, well, he wasn't. He was from the present owners. It was originally built by this famous Western star.
But he told us it was haunted.
And funnily enough, I came back years later and made another picture up here. I used the interior of the house, which we never used. We just used the exterior.
Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, for Dreamscape, we never went inside.
It's a great location because it almost evokes somewhere in the east with a, it seems like a rolling estate.
No, well, it's
larger
sort of like
than it is.
We're sort of playing off of what, the San Clemente and...
Yeah.
Right, we referred to it as the Western White
House. White House, yeah.
Begging your pardon, but it looks vast. It seems vast.
Are you sure it was a Western star? Because I remember it as a director.
Western star and... I think it was a Western star, and the wife was a writer. Yeah.
Okay. I think I've confused it over the years with another Hollywood haunted house story about a director who kept his cutting room in his home, passed away, and now his ghost every night makes the journey from his bedroom to the editing room to finish the film.
Great, that's a good idea for a movie. We were fighting the light here.
Yeah, it looks beautiful, though. Mm.
In fact, we didn't get enough sun earlier in the day when we were shooting that helicopter shot. Because I remember Brian Tufano, the cameraman, was upset, and we sang to him, "The sun will come out, Tufano."
I was only nervous because we shot... The reason it's late is because we shot two different scenes on that one day up here at the house. And the other scene was with... Eddie Albert and Plummer, and I had been told from another director from another picture that Eddie had done that he couldn't remember his lines on this other film, and so they had these cue cards prepared for Eddie, and that was the big nervousness. And when he got on the set, he never needed the cue card; he knew all his lines absolutely perfectly. So during a break, or at lunchtime, I had lunch with him. I said, "This other picture you did." And he couldn't remember it. And then he couldn't remember the name of the other picture. And then I told him the name, and he said, "Oh, I hated that movie. Hated everything about it."
Especially the words.
Well, he hated it, and that's why he couldn't remember. He said, in fact, that's why I couldn't remember the lines. Isn't that interesting? So it was nothing to do with his age. There's my friend Larry Gelman, and in the middle.
Yeah, this is our second About to Be Dream sequence.
And he and I had worked together before.
Well, you know, he's another example of... the public may not know that man's name, but I certainly recognize
him. Oh, from all the commercials.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, we decided in this dream that we would concentrate on those two other important elements of all dreams, sex and comedy.
Hard to distinguish between them sometimes in real life.
Dennis has a great line here.
It's wonderful, right?
Is that an ad lib?
No.
We scripted that.
We scripted that.
Wonderful.
Because, yeah. Now, if you'll remember this scene coming up, which is the sex scene, we had a lot of problems with it.
Ratings?
No. In the writing and the climax, pardon the expression, but the climax of the scene.
Yeah, the very end of the scene
did not work.
No, we redid it
and we reshot it.
Yeah,
and it taught me a lesson then, because when we were working on the script, I never liked it, and I let it go, and we had to go back and reshoot this.
Yeah, I don't remember how it originally ended. I think it just kind of stopped and
something. It just it didn't.
No, I know what it was. And when we get there, I'll.
Okay, because
I'll tell you.
And also the music. I worked with Maurice so long. We did about 7 different versions of this to get this music, what it is right now. It's one of my wonderful Maurice Jarre stories. In fact, I started with Joe and I made him change it so many times that Joe finally left and said, you just handle it. And about 7 times later, we finally got this calliope.
Right, this exterior was over in the valley somewhere.
Yes, it was. It's a wonderful street that looks like...
It's a street that gets used a lot.
Used a lot. Anywhere, old American towns.
Ah, there's that smoke.
Yep. No, this version is shorter than what we had before. Originally, it ends with violence and bloodshed.
That's right. I knew there was something.
The Larry Gelman character pulls a gun and tries to blow his brains out, and Dennis wrestles with him, and the gun goes off, and it kind of ends on a startling note as opposed to the
comedy note that it should have ended up. And I knew that, and I... That's the two. He's bald. The children. Now, this was... We had to have the thing with the children, and the children couldn't be in the same scene with the with her mother, so
had
we
to
had
be shot
separately for the foreign market.
I'll knock that off. I'm Jewish. I'm so sorry, Mr. Weber.
This is the reshoot. You too, Fukuda. That was Gelman's line. He came. You was there when we were. I think that was Gelman.
Yeah.
You too, and you. Yeah.
Oh, it's really raining outside that.
That
window.
One was, yeah.
This was at Claremont again.
I love it. Him saying "stupping" to your wife. That was great. Coming from Bunsido. But it was not one of our... I think it was the weakest in the scene in the picture. Just never quite...
The dream.
Yeah, that dream.
I agree.
Yeah, it never quite worked. And
well, once again, we wanted to try to show that something that, you know, how dark it could suddenly turn, and it never quite worked in that context.
And I learned my lesson. If you're not happy, I don't care how long it takes, keep working on it, because, you know... Like the ending. Remember how many times I made you guys go back to work on the ending?
Yeah, we redid that a lot of times,
and then until you finally got it, that thing, you know...
In fact, we figured it out pretty late in the shoot, I think, and had to kind of scramble.
No. This was in the... before we started the picture.
We were still working on that very tag.
No, you had it before.
Did we?
Yeah, you had it before. Because that's what... I made you do that, and then this one I let go, and I was always upset that I let this one go.
No, I think the reason I remember it differently, Bruce, because we had to bring an actor back, and we weren't sure whether we could get the guy.
The guy that plays
the conductor.
The conductor. Oh no!
Yeah, I think we knew where it was going to take place. I don't think we knew all the characters who were going to be involved in it.
But
I think we were still kind of scrambling with it.
I remembered it differently, but that's okay.
That's why we're here.
That's right. Because at one time you were going to end it at the racetrack.
Right.
Children are taught to never lose control in a nightmare.
Now, Chuck or Joe, or both, came up with this story of the Sonoy, the dream people, and contend that it's true. But I still think they just made it up.
Yeah, it fools me.
And also, I think it was very much longer, and we had to keep, you know. Here's the University of Pacifica, raining. I like this with the bells and the baseball mitt.
Yeah, we fleshed this character and this relationship out in the rewrites. Originally, Buddy was a very sort of incidental character, and there wasn't much of a relationship established between he and Dennis.
And the kid was a real pro. He'd acted a lot, and you needed somebody that was a pro.
He came from a family, I think,
of actors. Yeah,
performers.
Mm-hmm. He was very good.
I think he has a sister named Tina.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. She was in a series, in a television series, Tina Yothers.
Yeah.
Buddy Driscoll. Eh?
Each dream tunnel was designed a little differently, depending on which dream we were going into. Here they've added the element of the clock, which shows up when we get into the shot.
Mm.
We're on our Dr. Caligari set.
Right.
A lot of forced perspectives.
Buddy, what are you doing?
Are you the babysitter, Alex?
Yeah, I'm the babysitter.
Because most of the time they just leave me here.
You don't have to be afraid.
I actually think this is our most effective pop scare in the movie coming up here.
What do you mean, like the boogeyman?
He's outside. He wants somebody to get me. The Snake Man.
Oh, hey.
It's totally set up with misdirection and then sudden surprise.
Just let me see who it is, all right?
Well, I don't want to anticipate it, but I'm wearing the glove, and I was grateful after the shot that I didn't knock the little guy's head off, because I couldn't see what I was doing.
It's a great shot. No boogeyman.
Well, it's a classic horror. You go to the left and scare him on the right.
Yeah.
You see, there's nobody there.
And I had experience, because I'd done the horror movie before this, so...
There we go. There's Craig's hand.
Almost got him, though.
That's my dad, but he won't help us.
We have a flash cut of the whole suit coming through the window there. Yeah, a full-scale suit.
I love it with the lightning behind him.
Yeah. This is one of everybody's... More people remember this.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody's been down those stairs in their dreams.
That's a nice piece of cell animation that Peter's company did.
This...
And they did this.
Yeah. Great.
Come on, come on.
Around the bend, they're going to meet my actor friend Larry Cedar in the Snake Man suit.
That's right.
Larry's another one of those actors people would recognize.
If they saw his face, yeah.
But not
somebody.
In his suit.
Oh, very much. Millions of commercials there. Once Larry gets through the door, there are some substitutions with an animated miniature.
It's amazing. Yeah,
such as that.
Mm-hmm. We had such problems with that, remember, Craig?
Mm-hmm.
And in post and everything, making it all work. And
yeah. There are insert shots that feature the suit.
I'm watching this and thinking, it was wonderful.
That's the suit, of course.
Yeah. What we did on really not a lot of money.
No, it's
it was a high-quality movie on a low budget.
But no, it came with a $5.5 million, and it was originally at 20th Century Fox, as you know.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to make the picture because it was budgeted there at 12.
Yeah. What do they know?
Yeah. Well.
Well, they ended up releasing it.
Yeah. It was tough.
Of course, the head falling into the endless pit there was also handled by Peter's company,
mm-hmm.
with a nice replica of what we had done with the suit.
Yeah, I like that shot.
Mm-hmm.
You did it, buddy. You killed him.
It was a great audience scene. The audience loved it.
Yeah. And once again, Dennis, by God, you know, he jumped on that darn rubber suit like it was... a living snake man, and we had everything we could do to fight him back from behind.
Who did this sketch?
Len Morganti.
Right.
God, you have a great memory.
Well, I recognize
Len
Stout. Len did storyboards for the picture, I should point out.
Len's done storyboards on almost every picture Joe's done since this.
Yeah, wonderful, sweet, talented person. Now, we of course, it's a nicely constructed scene because Tommy Ray is taking notes here.
Yeah, we're setting it up.
He really listened to our hero when he said, "This thing shook me up."
I love that line.
Yeah.
Yeah, we might point out that originally written, this script was almost impossible to make, you know, for not a lot of money.
I remember scenes, David Wright, with an entire wasted city, and
yeah,
they're very, very well suggested in the final product. Very
yeah,
nicely.
We had a...
We don't really miss that scope.
No, I think it all worked out. I remember we had sort of a post-Holocaust New York...
Enormous.
Yeah.
We must point out that it was actually your original script that Joe had found in...
Yeah, I wrote it, I guess in like 80, 81, sold it to 20th Century Fox, sort of sat on a shelf.
That's it?
Joe found it in
an agent's
office.
Agent's office.
And brought it to you.
Right.
Then Chuck and Joe did a rewrite, and then I came back...
Well, actually it was Joe who was going to rewrite it, and then he didn't want to work alone... And he said, could he bring in Chuck to work with him? And so I said, sure. And then they did that. And then they said, can they give it to you to read? And then they said, could you come in?
Right. I kind of wriggled myself back in there.
But also, there was, for me, I must tell you now, after all these years, that first draft was hard to understand, too.
You know what, though? I'll tell you something. Having looked at that draft not that long ago, it's very close to the finished film.
Really?
A lot of the stuff that we... added ended up being stuff that we tended to shave down, you know, because we didn't need it ultimately, you know, because we had buffed up these characters and relationships so successfully that we found that there were a lot of things that we could cut in the editing room that didn't really affect the picture.
Sure, I saw you on TV.
Yeah, that becomes an unconscious laugh, doesn't it? Where do I know you from?
I had to make up a fake blurb on the back of this book, which was, "Terror so real, you can cut it with a knife."
That quick shot. Insert.
Well, Charlie Prince was sort of a variation of Stephen King.
Right.
I know you're a part of it. About as much as I do.
Maybe I know more.
You got a point to make here, because I sure wish you'd make it.
I love Dennis's gesture when he hears his theory. Like, oh, yeah, right.
You want to guess what he does? He's with the government, right? He's more than just with the government. He's one of the most powerful men in it. Head of covert intelligence. The president's coming.
He was well cast also.
Yeah, well, if he's not powerful.
He was. The only jarring thing was, you know, a year or so later, how popular he'd become as Norm on Cheers.
But he's a good actor.
Yeah, he is.
And I didn't even when they brought him in, I never seen Dream Cheers.
Cheers wasn't popular
no,
in its first year or two.
There's Dennis. Whoa. We've all met our conspiracy, our flying saucer, or whatever theorist in our lives, and
that's right.
So this guy isn't credible until, of course, he's proven to be absolutely right.
Right. We have a whole, you know. Thing going on here with a political conspiracy, and let's kill the president. This, I think, turned out to be our cleverest scene.
The love scene.
Yeah.
Now, this is the scene where when they shot it, I don't know where I was, but they shot the scene, and she had had a facial the night before doing this. And when I saw the scene, I hit the roof because her face was all broken out from the facial. And I called up Stanley Zupnik, and I said, "This is just terrible. This is the great love scene in the picture, and she looks really bad." And I said, "I've got to go back and reshoot it." And he said, "Fine, go ahead." He was a terrific executive producer. And I went back and we fixed it. And then I screamed at Fran Maxwell, the makeup, and how could you do this? They were running behind, and she said, I don't want to shoot it, but Joe made her shoot it, and I told off Joe and the whole thing. As originally written, this scene was supposed to have nudity in it between them, and that's in fact why Kate didn't want to do the picture the first time. And then we came back and said, well, we're not going to have that much nudity. And that's when, you know, when Dennis went to convince her to do the picture. And as it turned out, it's much better without any nudity.
Yeah, we cut it down in the editing room. I think that was to get the PG-13 rating.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. But there was a little flashes and stuff, and then to get the PG-13, we had to tame it even more.
Right. I remember this was the day when everybody showed up on the set to watch, and we're not allowed into this very tiny, tiny space here.
And, yeah, I remember we were all outside. What's happening? What's going on? What are they doing? And it actually, people remember it as a very sexy scene, and you don't see that much. So it's like old-time filmmaking.
Yeah, it's very memorable.
Yeah, and a wonderful theme from Maurice Jarre. But this love theme, he called Joe and myself to his home in Pacific Palisades, Maurice, because he wanted to play the two love themes that he had written. And so he sat down at the piano and he started playing, and as he was playing, I thought to myself, I can't believe that I'm actually here listening to Maurice Jarre, who wants my opinion, the man who wrote Lara's theme, my opinion on what I think would be the best love theme. And he played the first piece of music, and
and you told him he was all wrong.
Well, I did. he played a first piece of music, and I said, okay, let me hear the second, Maurice. So he played the second, and it was this, and I said, well, that I like. And he said, good, Bruce, yes, I like it too, and that's this. I couldn't believe it. Here's where she looked really great, and we had a this was the reshoot right there. One of my favorite lines is coming up again.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just a dream, so it didn't really happen, did it?
No, it didn't.
So if it didn't really happen, then I shouldn't be upset, should I? But I am upset, damn it.
I can see that. I'm sorry.
You know, it would help a lot if you wouldn't be so goddamn apologetic and go back to your usual insensitive self. It's wrong. It doesn't take a genius to realize that what happened in the dream was something that we both wanted.
What are we going to do about that? I can't forget it.
Here.
Hey, Jane, there's one thing you overlooked. I entered that dream without any help or hookup. I did it all on my own.
That's his breakthrough. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, this was Claremont, right?
Yes, I think, yeah. The garden, some garden.
In fact, it might have actually been right outside of what really was...
I think it was.
Novotny's office.
Yes.
There was a wonderful blooper here. Plummer, who's, you know, is a consummate actor, but there was a line that he just could not get right, and he kept blowing it every time, and of course didn't even realize that he was blowing it. There's a line here about something the president intends to do to our nuclear deterrent, and he kept saying, to our nuclear detergent. And people would stop and say, Chris, you said detergent again. He did it about four or five times.
Gets all the stains out.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful scene, these two together, these two.
They were total pros.
Yeah.
It was such a pleasure to watch this being shot.
You and I are going to bring.
I remember Chuck Russell calling. He says, "Well, we've got," and he starts reeling off these names, and I thought, "You've got to be kidding me!" I was so impressed.
This woman who is playing Mrs. Matuszek, as a personal note, happens to be my mother's best friend and also a wonderful actress, Kendall Carly Brown. And to this day, she is stopped. People stop
really
her.
I remember
her just from this scene.
Good Lord. That's great.
Mrs. Matuszek. Look, I remember the name. How did you come up with that? That's a wonderful name.
She does a great job.
Yeah. It was a one-day part, and I must tell you, this is a sideline. I offered it to a college mate who was an actress, and she turned me down, saying, "I don't do one-day roles." And I didn't speak to her for years, and actually this one day turned into 7 days.
There's a great look on David Kelly's face there.
Yeah.
Get the D-tip ready. 400 watt seconds. Do you want bicarb? Yes, calcium chloride.
I think the other's there.
And this was clever. Everybody's concentration on her, with the exception of Dennis, who's checking out Tommy Ray's reaction. And then this scene is great.
Eating the sandwich.
Oh,
wonderful.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Alex, would you mind? I really gotta be alone. Shook up about Mrs. Matuszek. She must have had a bum ticket.
He nailed this scene, David, didn't he? He just, you know, every time we took it, every take, it was the same. He had it.
And what made it work was just the casualness of it. The thing with the sandwich and the drink and just, you know, totally indifferent.
I love that line.
Let's go. Let's go, or you're going to draw back the stump.
The woman died, Tommy.
So.
Everybody died.
David used to do exercises off screen before he'd come in and do these takes to get himself pumped up.
Yeah.
Something that's always caught my attention in these scenes in this room is that when you watch Plummer turn and walk away, it almost seems as if parts of the set disappear. They just sort of blend into an almost kind of that arch behind him, you know, which seems almost like it's fogged or dreamy or something.
You can't handle the move. My people will do it for you.
What are you up to, Blair?
Yeah.
And this was the Veterans Hospital, redressed.
My sole concern is the well-being of the president.
I don't know what there. But is it really the well-being of the president?
He was great. Just very quietly, coldly, sinister, going about his business.
We were just very lucky to get both of them.
Yeah.
How's my good right?
And this was fun, too, to watch these two snakes coil around each other.
Love the shot from the mirror.
You can see Tommy's Bruce Lee posters there. What I loved about this relationship was that Plummer's character, who knows this guy is totally unstable, but has to kind of coddle him, you know, has to kind of stroke him and build him up.
I don't, liked his line, "I don't take drugs, I'm messed up enough."
That hurt.
We
promise she had big plans for me.
This is the first time we realize that...
This is the first time these two have been together.
Yeah, and we realize that Blair is bad.
When I was watching this the other night, I realized that, you know, of course, this is 1983,
yeah.
Of course, he breaks into the office here and breaks into the file cabinet. When was the last time you saw somebody go through a file cabinet and not just hack into somebody's computer?
Hmm. Right.
Although I think he's got a computer screen back there next to his gin bottle. And why does a psychic need to break into the files? Can't he just...
Well, you wrote it. Use it.
Oh, yeah.
Probably because the people with the popcorn can't read his mind.
Yeah, there's the computer screen there.
Yeah. Some of these articles were kind of funny to write. Here's Tommy's father.
Tommy looks like his mother.
I think this was...
This is Claremont again.
Claremont, yeah.
This is where Joe got to flex his old pom-pom muscles.
Oh, with the...
with the cheerleaders.
Cheerleaders, yeah.
Actually, this was kind of a challenge for Joe, this movie, because prior to this, he had worked pretty much with teenagers and kids. And,
yes.
You know, this time...
It was first adult film.
Yeah.
Yes, because we had done a teenage picture together, Joyride.
Right.
Prior to this.
And Chuck worked on that, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Pep rally tonight.
Come on.
This was his homage to Hitchcock, yes?
Yeah, and this was probably one of the nights when it didn't rain, so they hosed down the sidewalks.
I know, and then this is very Hitchcockian. I remember. Was it like The Man Who Knew Too Much, I think? No. The Joel McRae.
Foreign
correspondent.
With all the umbrellas.
Yes, that's it. That's what we were doing, the foreign correspondent.
Hey.
I loved it. And then he just disappears.
I know Pete Caran's company sweetened that shot with that little flash. It makes it so macabre.
And actually, this went off very well, this night shooting.
It did.
Yeah.
Once they're in the car here, I think we were in Griffith Park. This drive?
Hmm.
Bruce, do you remember? I think we were in Griffith Park all night.
Now Griffith Park.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yes? Why?
Travel Town? Is that the area that it's called over there?
You're a real humanitarian, Blair. I'm a realist. We live in a dangerous, hostile world.
I can say that today.
Again, I think Joe was squeezed in at their knees there somewhere.
All real background, not...
Yeah.
Surely you can see the possibilities.
Just a couple moments ago, we pointed out that, you know, we don't use file cabinets too much anymore. And this scene, Dennis's escape, deals with the fact that we didn't seem to have power locks on our doors in those days.
All right.
Realize what that means.
It means no one's safe from you.
question is whether you're going to cooperate. I never had any doubts about Tommy Ray.
Well, why should you? He killed his own father. He's a fucking psychopath.
Alex, it's very simple. Either you work for me or you die.
Drop him! The stunt work in this, I think, was great, and all these action sequences are very well done.
They are. Jim Arnett was the stunt coordinator. Now, the voice of the motorcycle rider is Joe Rubin.
That's right, that's right. Yes. Oh, look at this.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
Good!
Good work, Joe.
We lost him.
Yes. I'm afraid he has to be killed. He can only hurt us now.
So casually spoken, I always love that.
Now we have the president arriving. Rather small motorcade.
He's coming in.
That's true. Nobody knows he's here.
We discussed that, remember?
It's always nice when the story saves you a few bucks.
Hello.
Jane.
Alex?
Look, listen to me.
We carried this telephone booth around with us a lot.
I remember. What was that for? Trying to get inserts or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, but you know, for that scene.
President of the United States?
Yeah.
I love that. President? I made that.
Yeah.
Of the United States?
The United States?
Yeah.
What?
How would he know, right?
No.
Again, this is from North by Northwest. This was the takeoff on North by Northwest.
We couldn't get the crop dust.
Now, right, so we have the car and the thing and the telephone booth.
We've got to stop Blair.
There's security everywhere. I'll leave the door open at the loading dock. I think it's your best chance.
You be careful.
Don't worry about me. You just keep yourself alive.
Count on it.
See? You know.
And, of course, that may be another thing we don't have that many of anymore. Telephone booths. They're a little archaic, too.
Everyone's got one in their purse or pocket.
Oh, that was the racetrack.
Yeah, this is Los Alamitos.
Los Alamitos. That was good, huh?
Hey, we didn't introduce any characters we didn't pay off later on.
That's right, I like this. It was great.
There's gonna be some people coming here in a couple of minutes. They're gonna be in a hurry, and I want you to slow them down for me.
No problem. Hey, Alex, you Welsh him. You're a dead man.
Look at that racetrack after the rain.
Yeah, it was muddy. But I think Dennis runs well in the mud. I think they handicap him that way. He's a good mudder. Now, Bruce, these were rental cars, and you didn't inform the rental car company of how you were going to use these cars. Do you remember that?
No, really? What a clever idea. I think you're looking at it, you know, now, this whole thing at the racetrack, coming back to the racetrack where... I remember we built that.
Yeah, I remember this shot.
That's pretty scary to me. And this too.
Tail.
Yeah, the horse's
the horse's tail.
Tail. Max plays this very well. This slow realization that he's screwed.
Hello.
Position, the lighting is also good in this.
Something is deeply troubling you. Let's sit down. Talk about it.
Should we really? Should we talk about what you intend to do to the president?
I thought that was clear.
Actually, this is one of their first scenes, I think, that we shot. And it was so exciting to see it in the rushes that you just knew you had something.
I think you're right, yeah.
They shot this first, and they were so good together. And
it's a good thing we did it that way, because it kind of gave us a lot of good feeling
about
where we thought we were going.
Absolutely.
I came to you.
I can never get over the ability of great actors to get themselves to a climactic moment on day one.
That is amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing.
I like that shot.
I love this line.
It's my eternal shame.
Great. He loved those profile shots, Plummer. Mm-hmm. And they did a lot of them with him. I love this with the trees.
Yeah, they're really shaking those trees out there. I remember a couple of grips standing out there shaking those trees.
That's a good shot.
Wonderful. Yeah. Film noir.
Yeah.
And the...
I was saying to Craig earlier that the beginning parts of the movie are rather episodic. But once everything kind of comes together, it really begins to roll in this last half.
Well, the setup, that the first half is the setup, yeah. Which reminded me when I did the trailer, I did the setup, and then what happens once you realize that there's somebody who's able to go into the people's dreams. And somebody said, oh, the trailer's too long, it's 2 minutes, and you can't have a 2-minute trailer. And I listened, and they cut the whole first half of the trailer out. And I remember seeing it in the theater, and you couldn't understand what the picture was about. You need to know the setup to make the picture work.
Especially with something like this, which was a hard concept really to sell.
Except today, when people say Dreamscape, and I said, yes, it's about, you know, the person who's able to go into people's dreams, then they remember it right away. I think the picture that we got confused with at the time was the Chris Walken movie that...
Oh, Brainstorm.
Brainstorm, yeah. Because it came out before us, and that was one with him and Natalie Wood.
Yeah, a few years before Dreamscape. And actually, just a few months after Dreamscape was Nightmare on Elm Street.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, they came to us. That's how Chuck Russell met the people from New Line, because they came to us to ask about who we used for the special effects and Chuck gave them information. I said, you got to talk to Chuck Russell because he did all that. He organized all the special effects.
And Chuck later ended up directing
Nightmare on Elm Street, the third one, which he and Frank Darabont took a lot from Dreamscape. It was called Nightmare on Elm Street, The Dream Warrior.
We were very influential.
Yes, we were, and he admits it to this day. I think I made him put that in, oh God, Paul, because I wasn't sure they'd recognize.
That's right, he was upside down.
Down and... Mm. They were, they were.
Blair's planning on putting Tommy away in the president's dream, right?
You tell me.
Yes.
How's he going to do it?
I remember an occasion when I told somebody that I had written Dreamscape, and they said, oh, I love Dreamscape. It's one of my favorite movies. I love the scene when Dennis is in the submarine and he sees the baby.
Right.
Interspace.
Yes.
When the president goes to sleep, they're all at one.
Good, I got rid of Chris Mulkey.
I think we should have given the president a bigger bed. A more presidential bed.
I think this is one of the last pictures that I did that I had smoking in it.
We had a lot of smoke on that set. Now we're into our final dream blowout here.
It's good.
Yeah, those tunnels still look good.
Yeah, they do.
Back in our post-Holocaust landscape here.
There's another terrific miniature that Jim Belaholdick and others working for Grand made, I think.
We wanted to make this the theme park ride.
Listen to me. Your life is in danger. Bob Blair is trying to kill you.
What the hell are you talking about?
He sent somebody into this dream to assassinate you.
Who are you?
I'm here to help you. Look, all you gotta do is wake up.
Wake up?
That's right. Wake up. Try. Concentrate. Wake up.
They gave me a sedative.
Sedative? Well, we're just gonna have to ride this out till it wears off.
Great part of the Capitol over there.
Yeah.
I did this. I caused it. That's not.
It's a great idea, David, when you really think about it, you came up with. You, besides the Quaid being able to go into other people's dreams. Also the idea of somebody trying to assassinate the president in the dream.
Right, the idea that if you die in your dream, you die in real life. This is when David got to kind of kick the stops out here. He's pretty effective from here on.
No trouble at all.
Then move on, son.
This is a prosthetic hand. With little nails that shot up mechanically. And our poor cop's heart is actually a rubber heart with two air bladders here.
I think we were the first to do this heart deal that I've seen so many other times in
movies. Well, they did it in that the Indiana Jones film in that final year. Oh, David's wonderful in this. He's terrifying.
Yeah, I love when he goes into his ninja.
He seems
ninja.
To be in charge of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ninja bit is wonderful.
Now look at all your creatures here.
Yeah, these were executed with a broad hand deliberately because we always knew they were going to be shown in a nightmare world of shadows. And there, of course, is David temporarily being one of them.
That's great. It's like you can see the skull almost beneath his face.
It isn't you!
I think the wonderful notion of him is how protean he is here at the end. He becomes this and that. He's a frightening adversary. And of course, we're coming up on something here that I always sort of reminded me of the evil fairy Maleficent in Sleeping Beauty becoming a dragon at the end, and that dragon had to be killed, and that's basically what Tommy Rae does.
You're right. This is slaying the dragon.
Mm-hmm. And Alex is, you know, the good prince who will do it.
Alex. To save the king.
That's right.
That's great. Yeah,
these ninjas are great.
Yeah.
People remember these, too.
Hey, look at this guy.
You blew it, Alex. While you were fooling around with Novotny, I was learning how to take advantage of you.
I might say in advance that the transformation into the Snake Man, I wanted to still show David's features in the final face so that you had that idea that he's in there. It really is him. And I discussed with Chuck what could we do that would be different than stretching rubber heads, which were in vogue then, and I used replacement animation, many separate sculptures arduously done in post-production. They go by rather quickly. Today they would do it on a computer, but it was unique at the time.
I remember those heads. They were like a few inches tall.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember this, yeah.
There were into the rubber heads. Very quick effect, but, you know, different.
It took a long time. It was a lot
indeed
of work. Yeah, I remember.
I did the
moment. Here's all this great set that we had at Raleigh Studios.
Terrific.
We built this whole apocalyptic...
We had a little problem with the dogs, though.
The eyes.
Our dogs were going to wear these ghastly suits that we'd prepared for them, all blisters and horrible scarring, but they wouldn't get in them. The doggies had other ideas, so they shaved the dogs.
We added the eyes later.
Yeah.
That's right, I remember they shaved them. That was the solution, shave them.
And then when Fox did the ad, they didn't want the dogs in the ad. And I said, I want those dogs. We went to a lot of trouble for those dogs. We got to put them in.
Yeah.
We didn't discuss this before. In the original script, the Snake Man was a rat man.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Chuck and Joe sort of felt that since there'd been so many werewolf movies
and rat
prior
movies
to this, yeah.
That's great.
That they went with the snake.
Now, are we here in the... No, we're still
at Raleigh.
Raleigh.
I remember that set, yeah.
Yeah, great.
That's serious.
And then we take a little trip to Bronson Cave.
Well, that's right. Now we're in Bronson Caves. Yeah. And I remember being at Bronson Caves because you talked about the rain earlier. And this is where I realized we met our Waterloo on the picture because we got bogged down literally at Bronson Caves and the picture started running over. And I remember standing in all the mud and said, this is it.
Yeah.
But the result inside here, I think, was really great.
No, and the final result was terrific, but I'll never forget that day, then the rain and the mud, and I said, that's it for me. We're behind. This is where we lost time.
Bronson Cave, of course, we need hardly add to real film fans, has appeared in about 2 million movies, including Roger Corman epics, and it is a real cave, or at least made out of a real rock formation, and it's full of real dirt that got real muddy.
That's
that
right.
Rainy year.
I think its advantage, doesn't it have like three entrances that all kind of intersect?
And a wonderful big gallery, too, at the end of it, where they finally work their way into for the death of the Snake Man.
There he is.
This is our animated puppet, the Jim of Pearl animated.
Right, Jim of Pearl, right. Now, this is what we talked about. How did he
heal himself?
Where did this come from?
He's got dream powers
now.
Yeah,
I think he caught on to what Tommy was doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Tommy Ray.
And I love this transformation and the way he ends up sort of half Tommy Ray, half Snake Man.
Yeah. I kind of hated to see him show any remorse. That's one.
Daddy, I'm sorry.
Bam.
Got him.
Good job, Mr. President.
Maybe we should have, now looking back, maybe we should have had something come through him here.
He could have spurted a little blood out of his chest.
Yes.
He's dead.
Dead? I love that he says that.
That scene went on a little longer, do you remember?
Yeah.
Plummer grabbed him, shook him.
Oh, right, yeah.
Slapped him around a little bit.
But it works now even better, doesn't it? Dead? Dead?
He was so certain of the outcome.
It's okay. I stopped the bastard.
John. Before he did this scene, I was talking with Plummer. He was talking about the scene and how he was going to play it. And he said, "I shall play it as a rejected lover."
And I also remember about what he should call him. We discussed that, and the idea of calling him by his first name. You know, showing that their relationship, prior relationship, and. John again.
Well, we had another scene that we cut. Remember a walk and talk between the two of them that we shot up at the house in the hills.
Oh, is that the scene that's not in the picture?
Yeah. Yeah, it was about a.
That's right. Well, that was the scene. That was, yes, that was the scene where he knew all his lines.
Established a little bit more between them.
Hold it right there. Thank you for my life.
I'm just glad we got out of there in one piece, Mr. President. Sir, what about Bob Blair?
Blair. Very powerful man.
He's going to be coming after me. He can't afford to have me alive.
I'll assign some men to him.
I appreciate that, sir. But I think I should deal with this on my own.
That's right. That's why we called him the John and everything, to show that that's why we put it in, how he was more powerful than the president.
When he makes this turn, I think you can see the dolly reflected in the marble wall. A little of it. This was downtown LA.
Yeah, bank, wasn't it? Or something. Yeah.
How did you get in here?
Now, this we reshot. This was.
Yes, I did a version of that didn't seem to go over for people, although I preferred it. And an up-and-comer named Greg Canham did that one.
Yep.
The hands were still yours, weren't they?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Going to be late. Bob.
And now we're at Union Station.
Mm-hmm.
This was our tag that we were not really 100% sure whether this was going to work, whether the audience would recognize the conductor.
But they did. They
from
did.
The previous dream.
They
but they did.
They did. He has this wonderful, memorable face.
Yeah, we really lucked out and kind of had our fingers crossed. I remember hoping they'd get it, and they did.
See, that was all these lines are wonderful.
Tickets, please.
It was really what we needed at the end.
Yes, it was perfect. He was. Yeah, it works.
Well, it was a wonderful picture to work on.
It was. And it still works. It still holds up.
Yeah, it holds up well.
You know, and the proof is you can't, every time you go to a video store or something, it's out. And I hope that people will enjoy the DVD of this. Will certainly enhance it, and it's what I've always wanted, everybody to see it in the way, you know, in the wide screen, the way it was originally intended.
Well, they will.
Yes, they will now, thanks to Image. And fun going through this again,
yeah.
Bringing back the memories, going down memory lane.
Yeah, well, it's a little like looking through a photo album.
Yeah, and one of the memories that come back. And Larry Cedar as the Snake Man. He was good.
Bless him.
He's still around, isn't he?
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's terrific. Yeah, I see him do commercials. Now Chuck Russell, of course, big hotshot director, writer. Did Seven.
Basically, with Chuck, I remember a great deal of enthusiasm and positivism and his happy memories.
He was very good.
Yeah.
He had a good relationship. Actually, we did, I think, Seven pictures. This was the last one we did. Joanna Rae did about 4 or 5 movies for me. She's terrific today. She does all the David Lynch films. And Jerry Ketchum, additional second assistant director, he's gone on to it. And it's Jeff Staggs, did wonderful work. He came towards the end, you know, we were shooting and took over for Alan Jones. That's who started, and he took over for Alan. Linda Bass now, big time.
We should say also that the movie was pretty well reviewed when it came out.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And our lovely Kathy Sataga, who met Brian Tofano on the picture, and they were together for many, many years. Lorenzo's now a director and a film editor in his own right. Danny Schott, my assistant on many pictures. He's now out of the business. He got smart.
You broke him, Bruce.
You know. He's in the food business.
I remember once saying to you,
Susie DeSanto, wardrobe supervisor. She's now a very big person.
Dream Tunnel Effects, Dennis Pease. That's who it was. I remember the first time we saw the picture and I said, why are the opening credits so big? Do you remember what you said?
No, but you're going to tell me.
You said, so it'll look good on television.
I'm right. You see, you can read these now. See? It's one of my pet peeves. You can't read the credits at the end. They don't fix them, make them work. There's Jim Arnett, yeah, stunt coordinator. And sit back and wonder where all these film, like to see all these people again.
Won't they all be at the Dreamscape reunion party?
Maybe they will. I can find them all. Maybe they will. I hope so. Okay. Well, it's been good. Thank you very much. It's been fun going through this with you, David and Craig.
Great pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
And I have to do it again sometime.